commute into New York City, and it's like an hour train ride. It's not that bad, but an hour train ride each way, and then waiting for the train at Penn Station, driving home, sitting in traffic, and you're talking an hour and a half each way. So you leave your house at 6 o'clock in the morning, you know, get to New York 7:30, get to the office by 8, stay till 5, don't get home until, if you're lucky, 7. It was dark when you left, it's dark when you came back, and you haven't seen your kids or your wife.
Welcome to the Getting Simple podcast.
You know those little lizards that like their legs move super, super fast and they can actually like run across water? They're light enough and like they don't basically break the surface tension of the water. But if they stop moving their legs, they would totally sink into the water. Busyness is like, oh my God, I got to do all this stuff. I got to keep on going. And if I stop, oh crap, I'm not going to be effective or something else is going to go wrong. If you can keep all the balls in the air, things are okay. The minute that you look at one for too long or contemplate it, then all the other balls fall.
Hi everyone, it's Nono here, and this is the Getting Simple podcast. Today, I'm pleased to have you here, Matt, and that we have this opportunity to record finally. We tried this like 5 months ago or so, and I think things have turned right to even record a full interview in, I don't know, I would say, I don't know if it's a better moment, but maybe we can talk about more things today. Well, how is it going, Matt?
It's going great, Nono. Thanks for finally, we can carve out the time and sit down after, 4 or 5 months. I enjoy listening to the podcast, and I make sure to tell more people about it every time that that it comes up.
Well, thanks for your time. So Matt has been now my manager at Autodesk for almost 2 years. I used to work here at Boston. Now I'm working remotely from Spain. And he studied architecture at Carnegie Mellon University. He's been working with Autodesk products for around 20 years. 3 years of those were previous to the Revit acquisition. And then he spent around 10 years with Revit products and then 10 more years doing some other interesting stuff here at Autodesk. He currently is a senior engineer manager at the AEC Generative Design Group. And he previously also worked as an architect in Elkus Manfredi. And hopefully we're going to hear today what's next for you. What's your next adventure? Can you tell us a bit more about yourself?
Absolutely. Yeah. Thanks a lot. So yeah, I have a background in architecture and in computers and in business. So my undergrad, I did architecture at Carnegie Mellon, and then I did business minor and then concentration in computer science. So kind of literally a mix of all the things that I do on a daily basis. So I worked as an architect for a number of years in Boston and other places. And then in 1999, so about 20 years ago, then I don't know what the average age of your audience is, but probably not more than 30. So 20 years ago, there was a little startup in Boston that was called Charles River Software. And there were about 23, 22 people there. And they were, a lot of them were mathematicians and physicists. And they were doing this thing that turned out to be pretty cool. It was for a bunch of us that had played around with computers a lot and done a lot with programming and computer-aided design and figuring out how to do architecture with computers. It was kind of interesting because we'd all get together at night and talk about, you know, the things we're doing now, but over beers. And somebody said one night, hey, you should go talk to these guys. So I went out and talked to these mad Russian mathematicians. And the founder of the company, this guy, Leonid Raiz, interviewed me. And the only other architect they had working there was this guy, David Conant. And he looked at my design portfolio. And the other guy asked me a bunch of logic and math questions, like computer science interview. And it went back and forth all day, like interview, logic question, design question, logic question, design question, back and forth. So it was truly like that mix between the two. So they were building this software that turned into Revit, the industry standard for architecture and engineering now. And it was this idea of what we called then parametric building modeling, which is now kind of building information modeling, which is different than just digital drafting board. It was, you know, how do you make a 3D environment that's facile and is conducive to design, but then gives you everything else that you would get out of it, like all the documentation information from there. So that was a startup. We did a startup for about 2.5 years at that point and built a product and then got acquired by a company called Autodesk, where we all work today. That was about almost 17 years ago. We got acquired in 2002. So that's what I've been doing. So yeah, as you said, been working on Revit architecture and structure for about 10 years. And then beyond that, I basically did innovation groups where we did essentially serial entrepreneurial work, where we would start up small projects and put some smart senior people on it and try and build something. And if it worked, we'd put it out and we'd build a community and we'd build it up and build it up and build it up and have more people working on it internally. And then we turn it into a business. I think that was really valuable because it teaches that the idea of iteration and ideation, you know, what was then called like sort of a fail fast forward type philosophy, where you don't need 2 years of planning. You need to get some people together in a room kind of like this, like a conference room, put some stuff up on the walls, come up with an idea and just build it and see if it works. So we did that, combining building information modeling with an energy analysis and structural analysis. So getting into performance-based design, that was one aspect. We did, that was this thing called Vasari. We did what turned into what's now Dynamo, so computational design. And that, you know, came out of obviously a lot of other work in the industry. So we can talk about, you know, things like Grasshopper and Generative Components and Robert Aish and David Rutten and all these guys as well. Generally, over the last couple of years, or last 10 years, there's been this evolution of computational design as a philosophy and a practice, and how that ties together with the larger industry. So we've been doing a lot there. We also pushed into mobile and cloud. How do you model in an environment that doesn't involve a keyboard and a mouse? And how do you model in a way where everybody has all the information all at one time? Those are all pretty cool. And then getting into now, the project that you and I are working on is around optimization. And I'm not going to use the term generative design because I don't like that term. I don't think it means anything, or it means everything and nothing. But the idea of declaring what your goals are and any constraints that you have on a design problem is actually a really interesting problem that I think is going to be the next 10 years of design. So anyway, that's my background. I've gone from designing buildings to designing software to building software myself to running teams that build software to making teams of teams that build software and kind of everything in between. So yeah, it's been a really good ride. I've been looking at things in a macro scale, right? So like 10-year cycles. So 10 years of building something and then seeing how it works and building something else and having a philosophy around that. And there's a 10-year cycle that we're embarking on now that's sort of kind of related to the macroeconomic cycle. And that has to do with using computers in a smart way to not just design something, but make things. There's been a lot of talk over the last 10 years about in architecture around mass customization and digital fabrication and, you know, 3D printing and using robots and all this stuff and a fetishization of these tools. But no one's really done it as a business yet and made a product or made something that is scalable. So that's what we're going to do. I actually just left Autodesk after a long, long time. And we have a great team here. I have a super happy with the team that I was able to build. I said, like, over the last couple of years, I haven't been building software. I've been building an organization and finding the right people to fit together to make the things we need to make. And now that part is done. Like, we have a great team. We have the people in place and we have a strategy. And now it's time for me to do something else. So I'm going to do fabrication. I'm going to switch to a slightly different industry even and go work for a company that the brief that they asked about was, we need somebody that knows about architecture and how to put buildings together. We need somebody that knows how to put software together and has done software development and software engineering building teams. We need somebody that can be people manager and knows a little bit about robots and fabrication, and, you know, digital kind of making of things, which, you know, given the work that we've done together, you know, teaching workshops about robots and all the sort of crazy things that we've been doing in the industry for a while, that was pretty interesting to me. So this company actually makes electric cars, and they have a philosophy of standing up new businesses and new product lines and building what they need from a capability themselves. So architecturally, it's actually pretty similar to other things that have happened in the industry, like something like WeWork or Katerra, where the phenomenon is different. Like, it's not different teams coming together and different legal entities and companies coming together. It's all vertically integrated in one company. And when that happens, when you can control the planning process, the financial pro forma, the architectural design brief, the engineering design brief, all the requirements. You design it, you procure it, you fabricate it, you assemble it, and you operate it yourself. That is really efficient because you're not sending all that stuff out to bid. There's not other parties involved. So that's kind of what these guys are doing. So this company is Tesla, and you might have heard of it before. It's kind of, you know, it's pretty cool. I've been a, you know, fanboy for a long time. They're doing some pretty amazing things. So right now the big push is on the Model 3, which, you know, has had a pretty big launch over the last year. And none of this is proprietary or confidential. I don't work there yet. This is all just news that you can find if on a Google search. But if they can get that cost down for a Model 3 from roughly $45,000 to $35,000 or lower, and make enough of them, whatever it is, 500,000 a year, then that is basically in the same territory as a Honda Accord or a Toyota Camry. Like, that's approachable by like a normal person that, you know, just needs a car. And the thing is, this car has 1/8 of the moving parts of a normal car. It potentially could last a lot longer and obviously is much more energy efficient. For the same thing of going about 310 miles, it costs about maybe $6 or $7 of electricity versus $45 or $50 of gas. So that changes the economics of owning a car pretty dramatically. And that's what they're trying to do. And they're trying to get that cost down by automating and building things themselves. So that's a pretty interesting problem. So that's what I'm going to go do. Go do engineering and software development for a big technology company that has a pretty interesting track record. And there's certainly a lot of challenges in that industry, but that's one of the things that's the next 10 years. So they're pushing fabrication super hard. They're pushing the way people work together really hard and have the possibility of changing the way these things work. The longer arc of that is, how can we do that for architecture too? Like, there's all these other industries. Like, we talk about aerospace and automotive are always, from a technology adoption standpoint, ahead of architecture and engineering, right? And there's a lot of reasons for that, but that actually is changing now. And how can we, it's not like 10 years ahead, it's maybe 3 years ahead. So how can we fail and fast forward? How can we find out what's working in different industries and bring it back to architecture and do it at a scale that makes sense and is economically viable to run a business? So that's where I think things are going. So it's using a lot of computational tools, a lot of, you know, designing based on goals and constraints. And a lot of those constraints are not just based on aesthetics or functionality. They're based on fabricatability or manufacturability or cost, performance of materials. All those things are super important. And learning about that in a different industry, I hope I can apply it back to architecture. So yeah, so I think for me, what I find really interesting is the people part, right? So we're all into technology and we're all into design. And a lot of what we're talking about here has to do with how we can do better work without overworking yourself. And a lot of that has to do with collaboration between people and finding the right people. So I mentioned I've been able, really fortunate inside of Autodesk, to run these different projects and to build products that are used across the world. And the thing that made that possible is finding the right people. So finding creative, talented people that have a breadth of skills. Not everybody has the same background in computer science or in design, or not everybody is like, you know, Ivy League education or something like that. But you find the right people and you get them all pointed in the right direction and amazing things can happen. So that's what I think is really interesting.
Big organizations like Autodesk go through many changes. As we mentioned, there are these kind of 10-year spans that maybe technology changes or the whole world changes and it affects the cycle of, or the goal of the company. How and why are those changes possible, you think?
Any organization or anybody that has a habit or, you know, something that they do on a daily basis, that becomes their routine, that becomes comfortable, that's the way things always were. So if you introduce any element that changes that, it causes a disruption, like literally. And that can cause stress, and people don't like stress. So the psychological aspect of it is, how do you provide a reason for them to change that is more positive or more beneficial than the stress or the negative aspect of it? So change is hard. How do you help people understand how to change? And sometimes those changes happen like for you. Yeah, there's some massive change like in the industry. Like we all have these smartphone things now that kind of are in front of you that are able to do some amazing things. That's not something that happened overnight. But if you look at the adoption there, there's more value in having these capabilities with you than any negatives of, you know, being always connected and everything else like that. The same thing happens in the way our organizations change. Like, so in architecture and engineering, there have been these major technical innovations that have happened over the last 30 years, right? So it went from drafting things by hand and drawing boards to something like AutoCAD or MicroStation, which is like a digital drafting board. But they're all great tools. I mean, I grew up drawing things by hand, like sketching, drawing manually. And then not until really in college, we started using computers more. And then it was like, oh yeah, I should use those because they're more efficient, but still getting the craft of the drawing and the feel of design. But it took the industry a lot longer to take that on. So going from manual drawing to CAD took a long time. And then going from 2D drawing to 3D modeling and building information modeling took a long time too. And those are, you know, 10, 15 year cycles that we're talking about. And now we're at a point where it's literally kind of what's next. Like, so there's another change, right? So the idea of going from something you're comfortable with and familiar with to introducing a new thing that people aren't familiar with, why should they change? Like, what is the value? And a lot of what we talk about in sort of anybody using computers uses it to be more efficient. If you think about it, like there's a automation aspect. The computer can help you do something faster than it was before, or better precision or more quality or whatever. So when you're doing something like a design industry, how do you translate that? Do you have a fixed fee that says, okay, I'm going to charge a customer this much money or a client? How do I put my hours and my people hours into that and make a profit? So you figure out envelope, back of the envelope, like estimate, it's going to take this many hours. So if it takes you less hours than that, what do you do? Do you charge less money? Do you iterate more and do a higher quality design? Or do you do something else like that? Do you go home earlier? Like, do you still charge the same amount of money, but not work your people as much? That's usually where change happens in an industry, is if it becomes more efficient. That's a forcing function. But then there's the psychological aspect of getting people to adopt something new. I mean, going even like in Photoshop, like how many times has Photoshop done a new release where people say, oh, I don't want to use that. That's too much change, or, you know, InDesign, or, you know, the newest version of anything, right? Why don't people adopt things right away? Because it's hard, because it's going to be different than what they're used to.
Yeah, you always have the legacy function where people are too afraid of just jumping to a new one because, I mean, people are just comfortable with what they have.
Right. And the same thing, I mean, even like with obviously a lot of the web technologies that we're all using today too, like the sort of days of desktop software are a little bit less, right? Like there's a lot more applications and services that we all subscribe to that aren't really desktop at all. They're all a service that is being provided.
Yeah, it's kind of a funny model, because now you were talking about updating Photoshop, and in some way you can opt out of updating sometimes. But, you know, if a website just pushes new code, then that's what you got, and you got to stick with it and learn the new way.
Exactly. But that, you can see how psychologically that causes stress for people, because the thing that they learned isn't there anymore. So what you have to do from a software standpoint is provide more value. Don't just change things because you can, or because there's a design that you want to implement. Like, why is it better? And that gets back to working with users really closely and figuring out what they care about. And that's what I really think that the philosophy of a user-centered design is, you know, with a lot of research, a lot of testing, a lot of iteration, is the way that any software should be made. Because then you can nail down and dial in like what you care about and build that, and don't build the other stuff. But getting back to, like, you know, the next thing, like, okay, there's 2D to 3D, there's using more and more of the information, using more analysis and optimization. But how do you take the tools that we have and apply them more effectively? And in a problem like architectural design or anything else, like it's very subjective. Like, you don't have a clear, well-formed, like optimal state. Like, there's always something that's subjective. So how do we help designers change the way that they're thinking about the world and declare more intentionally like what their goals are? But how do you have a language for how to construct those goals in a way that the computer can help you optimize around them or come up with a better answer in a way that is understandable? And you don't have to be, you know, a computational design expert to create them. So that's an interesting problem.
Do you have any specific examples of changes that Ordes has gone through while you're working here? And also any things that come to mind of maybe things that have changed in products that have caused stress to the users?
Oh, sure. Yeah. I mean, there's been a lot of changes. I think going from traditional desktop software that you pay a certain amount of money for, and you have a seat of software, but you have to install it, you have to maintain it. That's all changed to be a subscription model where you're buying a service. And it's kind of the same as like what Adobe's done, where it kind of doesn't matter. Sometimes it's a desktop software that gets installed. Sometimes it's a web thing that, you know, you're accessing. At some level, the user doesn't really care. They're, as long as they get their job done efficiently, okay, that's great. Like I use Lightroom, like, you know, classic, and then regular Lightroom. Same thing with a lot of the tools that Autodesk is making. They're kind of blended between desktop and cloud, but you're doing subscription. So that's one change. And that's actually something that Revit did. Like you could subscribe to the software instead of buying it. The other thing is the push for openness and open source, which is actually a really interesting phenomenon where I think traditional software development process was there's a set of features, they're getting requested, there's a new button in the interface that does something, but that's like a diminishing returns problem. Like you're never going to solve the problem for everybody. So how do you give the level of flexibility to people to solve their own problems in a way that is accessible to them? Historically, it used to be providing an application programming interface, like an API that you could use to customize, but then you have to know how to code. Not everybody knows how to code. So how do we provide openness and accessibility in a way that more people can use? And that's where concepts around visual programming come up, where they're more approachable. So you're still effectively working on top of an application's object model and their API, but it's in a way that is graphical and understandable. That's one aspect of change, like of literally being more open. The other aspect is actually relying on open source software. If you're a tech company and you're standing up your own technology stack, you're building your own user interface widgets, you're building your own backend and not relying on things, you're not leveraging the vast amount of technology that's available in open source. I mean, I haven't seen very, very many models of that working. And by the same token, you don't have to be fully open all the time. There's still things you can monetize on top of that and, you know, make money. But leveraging existing open source and also contributing back out to the open source community. You know, there's a lot of great examples of that. You know, obviously things like Java from a long time ago, just even Android development in general, you know, the work that has been happening around any web technology. Just look at any of the libraries that you need to make a website these days. They're pretty much all open source and they're all being in some level funded by tech companies. You know, look at the contributions that Facebook has made or other people. They're all out there. So how can you leverage that? And that's a larger philosophical change than any existing change. Like how do you embrace open source and not open, you know, free as in beer, like and free as in speech. It's like literally how do you use these technologies to provide more value and more service for a small company and leverage your people and your talent more effectively by using these things that already exist.
Yeah, and to what you mentioned, for example, the whole Dropbox website is built with Facebook technology, with React. It's an open source technology. You have to look at big companies that are reusing the things that other people are putting up and maybe saving a lot of time and effort on something that already works well and just grabbing it and using it. And that also contributes to more people contributing to it because maybe, you know, maybe now Dropbox wants to improve something and then collaborate on their open source project or something like that. We keep trying to automate more and more processes, and Autodesk in particular in the architecture, construction, engineering industry. How would you define what automation is, and what do you think the consequences of automation in our daily lives are to be?
Oh, that's a great question. I mean, at a broad level, like automation is the ability to have some level of other service or agent doing things for you, right? So you're spawning these other things that are doing your work and bringing it back. If you can make a process more efficient, like we've talked about before, that theoretically can save you time or money or whatever you're trying to optimize for. So it really comes down to, for any task, how do you do it more efficiently? And that might be less time, it might be more higher quality, you know, lower cost, whatever you want. The practice of automating, you know, is usually taking something that was impossible, making it possible, and then making what was possible more approachable, and then just optimizing that down till it's just happens automatically. So you think about like something like recommendation systems is like an example that we use a lot, where it's around you all the time. Look at something like Netflix, look at Amazon, look at even just like autocomplete in any technology that you're using on the web. All of those are built with a back end that tries to infer based on what they know about you and the context to help come up with a better answer. So that's actually a pretty good example of an optimization or making something more automated. Here's something that you could have done yourself. Find the movies that are most like this, but it happens for you in the context of literally you typing something and the results appear. So automation doesn't have to be you writing code or taking a task that you've done for a long time and making that more efficient or something that you can run like a script. It can be literally something else that is around you and just happens for you. But in the case of InDesign, typically it comes down to taking a task that you might do a lot and you write a script for it. And usually that comes down to like a return on an investment problem. You know, it's going to take you 8 hours to do something. You know, the first time you write some code for it, maybe it takes you like 4 or 5 hours to write. And then the thing runs like in a minute and you're done. So you still save time the first time. But then every other time, if this happens every week or every 2 weeks or every 4 weeks that you need to do this, now you have a script in your back pocket that can do that faster. And it's also adaptable and modifiable and reconfigurable for solving other problems that are like that one. So in the context of like a design practice, that's usually what automation means, is take a workflow that is possible and it evolves over time between people and write it down and write some code around it and then just rerun that and it happens. And the cool thing about that is that it can happen in the background, like while you're not working. One of the things that is tricky about service industries where you're designing things is there's a strong correlation between your physical time and how much money you can make from a project, right? And that's a kind of old school way of thinking, like, oh, that'll take me 10 hours to do. Therefore, I can charge a client, you know, whatever my rate is, that's fine. But if you did it the other way around, say, this is like fixed fee or whatever, and you can automate the hell out of that, then you're making more money, you can save more time, you can go to your kid's soccer game, you can go home early and read a book and have dinner, all that kind of thing. So it comes down to what you're trying to optimize for.
Yeah, touching on that you just said, how would you go about putting a price on something? Because this is a conversation I always have in terms of, okay, do I charge because I'm gonna, as you said, spend like 80 hours doing this project, or do I charge some specific fee, and then if I can make it in 8 hours, then that's it. I always put the example of, you know, the really well-known designer that might take 3 hours or 1 hour to sketch a logo. They might still charge, I don't know, $40,000 for doing the branding. So if you're charging per hour, maybe when you get really good, I don't know, it's kind of counterproductive, right? Like, yeah, when you get really good at it, you're going to charge less.
That's a tricky one because, I mean, a lot of design profession, both architecture, engineering, but also, you know, graphic design, interaction design, product design, you have to think about like the business side of it. And many times, like designers, you know, myself included, you kind of think, oh, my ideas aren't that good. Like I'm going to knock out something quickly and doesn't have a lot of value because it only took me 3 hours to do. But that's not looking at it from the user side or from the client side, which is, you're providing a service. You have a professional skill, you have talent, and you're providing a service that these guys can't do. That's why they hired you. So what is that worth? And that's actually the tricky part, is figuring out what not your time is worth, but what the service that you're providing in culmination is worth. And that's a tough problem in the industry, especially when you're just starting out, because it's easy to come in and say, well, I think it's worth this. And it might be that, you know, you could charge 3 or 4 times more. There's this guy, Mike Montero, who's a interaction designer, and he runs a company in California. Can I curse on this podcast.
Yep.
So he, I would encourage you in the show notes to link to his, he's done a couple good presentations and he's got, you know, a couple books out on how to basically be a designer and a conscientious designer, but one that actually can run a business and feed your family. One of his main premises is basically fuck you, pay me. Like, which is, I'm providing you service. I'm giving you value. Here's what I think it's worth. Maybe some people are looking for something cheaper. Great. Go to, you know, some sort of task service and you can knock something out quickly. You know, if you need a logo, great. There's plenty of different places that, you know, you can basically bid for lowest common denominator logo. But if you need higher value service and quality, that's usually where things kind of get differentiated. But basically his premise is like, your time is worth something. So stand up for it. You know, you're providing service and value that no one else has, and that's worth something. And it kind of doesn't matter how many hours it takes. And that's where optimization of your process and automation comes in. Because if you're doing good work and you have a good team and they work well together and you can automate things and systematize them, there's no reason why you can't live like an actual, like fairly reasonable life. And it's not about getting rich. It's about being comfortable and optimizing for the things you care about. A lot of this stuff doesn't have to be totally capitalistic and like making a huge amount of money. It's simply, how do you make enough to be comfortable and be able to pay your employees like a reasonable amount and treat people well? That's what it comes down to.
Yeah, now that we're talking about this, I don't really know where I heard it, but I've used this strategy sometimes for like, you know, budgeting a freelance work or something. And many times you say, okay, I'm not going to take any more jobs. I don't have more time. I cannot do it. So instead of doing that, what I started doing, I don't know, maybe 5 years ago, I'd said like, okay, I'm going to think of the price that I was thinking on charging. I'm going to multiply by, I don't know, by 2, by 3, by 4, by 5, depending on how busy you are. And you multiply by 5 and you say the price. And if they don't accept it, it's on them. They're the ones that didn't want to do the thing. You said, yes, I will take it for this much. And the surprising thing is that many times you will be surprised that they accept it. And they say, actually, okay, we'll do it for that. And then you say, like, I was going to charge $10 an hour and they accepted 50. So maybe you can scratch some hours and some time to do that. I'm not saying that's what you should do all the time, right? But it's also a good strategy to filter out, because people like probably Mike Montero, that's the strategy that he takes is, okay, I'm going to filter out clients. I'm going to get clients that value the craft I do and value that my time, you know, or my knowledge, as you said, my expertise is worth something.
Mm-hmm. And it's possible to fire clients. Like, there are some clients that are simply not good. Like, they're not healthy for you to interact with. If someone is nickeling and diming you and saying, oh, you're just doing this, how come it's not cheaper? Is that really the type of like relationship you want to be in? Like, think about that from like just a friendship or like a, you know, from a, like a personal relationship. Like if you had a girlfriend that was doing that, or, you know, some interpersonal thing where they're always like, oh, you're no good. How is that great? Like, you know, why not have a mutually beneficial, like you're providing value, they're getting something out of it, and they kind of give you, you know, some level of feedback, like, okay, this is good stuff. So yeah, so I think that there's a lot to that. There's also another aspect to this that I think is really cool. Like when I first got into software, one of my first bosses, he said, we're all kind of like nobody's like a natural businessman. And I'm not a business guy. I mean, I like making stuff. I'm just trying to find an industry that I can make stuff in efficiently. But he said, you need to find a business that will make money when you're sleeping, which is actually a really profound thing. Like, how do you provide, especially in a service-based industry, how do you do that? You can do it in a couple different ways. Like one is like having your reputation kind of precede you, like having, and it's easier in social, in online presence, like it's easier to control how you come across online. So your reputation can go a lot farther than it used to be like 10, 15 years ago. But also that's where automation comes in, because if you can have a process, it doesn't have to be a product. It can still be a process or some kind of like service-based thing. But if you can automate it, there's an efficiency gain that literally lets you make money while you're sleeping. And that's a different way to think about things than kind of normal service-based industry.
Another thing that I wanted to say to follow up this conversation is that one of these, so the new 10-year cycle that we're in right now has to do a lot with artificial intelligence.
Yeah.
With artificial intelligence and machine learning. How do you think that's going to undermine, I'm quoting, like undermine the work that designers do? It's not only about automation saving you time. It's also about, we don't need you to do this anymore. And I mean, we can see some examples of companies that are trying to automate. I mean, I just read today, hire.com, right?
Where, some of our former former friends and colleagues, yeah.
Peter Boyer, right, is working there, and their first slogan is like, design your house without the need of hiring an architect, right?
Oh, that's a whole another topic. I mean, that discussion of like how do architects provide value and differentiate themselves and kind of not get disintermediated has been going on for a long time.
I put always this example, right? I do urban sketching, sketch on site. My mom does as well, and she also does portraits, right? So that just what you said is something that we have in mind when you're going to charge for commissioning if you want to sketch somebody's house or make a portrait of your cousin or something like that. If you now create things like Adobe Research are doing, like you create a filter that basically gets a picture and, you know, creates a portrait or like makes a Van Gogh or something like that, where's the value on creating something by hand anymore if it can be automated, right? I mean, I know that one of the things is like for some people, they will want the quality or the like treat with a human that's going to do it or something, the craft, the human craft, right? But what happens when that's lost? What's going to happen with the, who are you going to pay?
That's a good point. Yeah. So I think you can take this from a couple different directions. The idea of replicating something that was unique before is an interesting problem. And even if you take it from a painting standpoint, like, okay, the original painting, like there's that interaction, like you just talked about, like a portrait, there's that relationship between the painter and the subject and, you know, a dialogue that happens like in that interaction, and that makes it more meaningful and valuable. So what does it mean when you can make like a copy of that painting? You know, there were like just offset printing, for example, like there's a lot of ways to make replications that are actually, they look pretty good. They're obviously not the same quality as the original, but when you have a copy of a Van Gogh, is it still a Van Gogh? It's a representation of the original. It's kind of the same thing. I mean, like Photoshop filters have been around, come on, for like 20 years. Like, yeah, I mean, and like even someone like, what was it called? Kai's Power Tools, like back in like the early Photoshop days. I mean, like, yeah, you could do pretty amazing stuff, like from a image processing standpoint, like it was pretty hardcore. And obviously now, like when you get into like more gesture-based and sort of like following not just the artifact, but the process to make the end result, you can get some pretty amazing things with the stuff that Adobe Research is doing. Same thing for replicating any process. You can have a tool that is watching a process and quote unquote learning from it. And that's always been the case. Like any automation, like there's this great example, like of the origin of sabotage, like the term sabotage, which was basically, you go back to the creation of the loom, right? So like the Industrial Revolution, right? You take the process of making cloth, which used to be very handcraft, and you know, people that were working with literally spinning the, you know, the thread and, you know, working with the yarn and making these things up. All of a sudden there's this process and big industrial plants that are happening. So what do? They throw their shoes at the thing to break the new machine that is replicating the task that differentiated them and made them feel special before, but it became automated. It became more industrialized. And that was a threat because the thing that made them special wasn't there. How they made their livelihood was less there. So literally they threw their sabot, their shoes into the machine to sabotage them. So how do you apply automation in a way that doesn't threaten or doesn't take the original person out of the mix? Like how do you do it in a way that helps them become more engaged or more empowered? That's the trick. Because automation can be dehumanizing if you literally like take something that was a craft in whatever way. It doesn't matter if it's painting, if it's making shoes, if it's making cloth, if it's making, you know, industrial like tools, like really good tools. How do you do that in a way that keeps the craftsman involved, but scales or enhances or leverages what they can do and makes it more valuable?
I mean, I think from the point that if there's something that gives meaning to your life, might be, I don't know, like making websites, maybe it's like too digital, but like sketching or writing or things like this. I cannot really imagine like what would happen if you have a machine that does that perfectly. So what, you know, how do you find your daily meaning now? I mean, as you said, probably new ways of interaction that human in the loop, right? you have a different role. Might be curating what the machine is writing, or might be correcting it or something.
I mean, that's what we've seen it evolve. Like, and that gets back to the change aspect that we were talking about before, where even in, you know, amazing design companies that we've worked with, and even with super intelligent, creative, passionate people that have made like a niche in their space, like they've made a contribution professionally and creatively, if you introduce a technology that feels like it is taking away something that they've provided value, that's a threat. Like, that's something that they don't like. But if you look at it a different way, the thing that made you special for 5 years now is being taught in every single school around the world, and now is being automated, you know, by people that are writing their own scripts and putting them out on GitHub and, you know, making packages and sort of like things out on, you know, Food for Rhino and other places. Like, so move on. Like, the next thing is what you should be doing. The benefit that you provide isn't the thing that you made 5 years ago. It's the thought process that got you there and solving the next kind of problem. Like, it's not that automation is inevitable or progress is inevitable and it's always going to be, you know, we're all going to be designing Walmarts in a couple of years. Like, there's something more to it than that. And a lot of it comes down to what kind of problem do you want to solve, or what contribution do you want to make, and how do you share? It actually goes back similar to like the open source kind of philosophy. It used to be where if you innovated and you made something, that was precious. Like, that was this thing that you had to guard, and there were, you know, there's still patents and things like that, but like, no, you can't have my thing that I made. Now there's a sharing kind of economy. Put it out there and people will learn from it and make it better. So it's kind of the same thing here. If you've done something interesting and changed a process and helped people be more efficient or productive or creative, and now it becomes automated, that's an opportunity for you to share your knowledge more broadly and move on to the next thing.
Just to give a few examples. So in the world of machine learning, mm-hmm. we've seen, for example, Gene Kogan mm-hmm. and yeah. Mario Klingemann
yeah.
mm-hmm. right, at Quasimodo on Twitter.
Yeah.
You know, these are exceptional cases because it's like one or two guys that right the day when some open source machine learning algorithm goes out, he basically leaves everything and starts, or at least this is what I believe, right? From what I've seen online, uh-huh. leaves everything aside and say, okay, my focus for the next 2 years or 20 years, I don't know, mm-hmm. is just trying to make interesting artifacts with neural networks.
Yeah.
And the product after two or like 3 or 4 years is like he's kind of making portraits with neural networks by yeah. training them with, I don't know, Francis Bacon, like outcomes, right? I think the problem, and this is the generalized worry, is that not everyone has that ability of switching gears so fast, right? Even the other day we were at a Revit training, mm-hmm. right? And he said, like, the instructor said, if you change software again, as you did when you introduced Revit after AutoCAD, I'm retiring.
yeah.
Because, I mean, there is so much that you can, so much change that you can kind of mm-hmm. buffer on, like accommodate.
But tying it back to the machine learning part, I mean, we've all done research in this space and you know where the state of the industry is there. If you can generate a large enough training set in a tight enough domain that is understandable, like you can get a reasonable outcome. Okay. So you could make the argument like in the case of portraiture, like, okay, well, that's pretty clear. Like there's a subject, there's a gesture and a style, and you could probably replicate that or build a system that starts to understand like what good looks like there and whatever, however you define good, and kind of converges. But using that same system to like draw a landscape, probably not going to work that well. So it's not a one-to-one mapping. Like your ability to visually understand and perceive and kind of capture the essence of something is bigger than just you've had a training set of like whatever, 2,000 portraits to look at. So it's not about replacement. It's not about this will take your jobs. The robots are not coming to take your jobs. The robots are here to enhance the job that you're doing and augment your skills to make you more valuable. That's kind of the better way to think about it, or that's the opportunity, but that requires people to be open to change and learning some new things that they might not know already, which is scary.
Yeah, I personally think that the revolution that's coming is when people who don't know how to code or interact even with computers mm-hmm. can actually use intelligent robots and machines to do what they do daily, right?
Yep.
Because right now, I mean, you need to know how to fork a GitHub repo. You need to mm-hmm. know some command line.
I'm telling you, man, I have two sons that are pretty technical, 15 years old and 13 years old. And Minecraft like came out, whatever, 6 years ago, something like that. These guys were learning how to code without even knowing it. They were building logic systems just in Minecraft, using AND and OR and NOR logic to send signals through Minecraft, which is basically electrical and computer engineering. They were writing Java code without even knowing that they were writing it and copy-pasting it in instant messaging and sharing code without dealing with GitHub, moving stuff around to make something cool. And that was the feedback loop of like, is this interesting to them? And the same thing, you know, with things like Scratch. You know, my kids are, you know, they grew up with basically Scratch and Minecraft and Arduino, you know. So if you have that culture of testing something out and trying it and downloading something from the internet and using it, that's pretty wild. And how does that change their evolutionary thought process and their creativity, where it's not something that they needed to be taught? It's in order to solve a problem or do something cool, they needed to acquire a set of skills. Even now, like our colleague Zach, his son is upstairs doing JavaScript coding and he's 15. Like he's in a professional environment working on JavaScript. That's not because somebody taught him that. It's because he learned it himself in order to do his math homework faster, basically. It's equipping the next generation of designers and creative people with a new arsenal of tools. I mean, even like, I mean, we've talked about this before, like when you learn how to code and making websites and, you know, doing some other interesting work before you're even doing anything in architecture, but applying those skills to a design industry gives you a different set of skills than somebody else. So what does that next generation look like and how was their learning changed? Because it's very experiential, it's very task-based, and I'd be surprised if there's any like sort of JavaScript class anymore. It's like, oh, here's a cool website. I'm going to turn the page over and figure out how it works, that's pretty much how anybody learns how to code. Look at Stack Overflow. I mean, that's like the number of people that learn in a structured environment these days versus on their own at night because they're trying to figure out how to do something. It's entirely different. And that's because of the capabilities and all of the data that's available to you.
Yeah. And I would say it doesn't matter what field you are in or what you're learning, what you're studying, where you're working. If you learn some coding or at least the basic concepts, you're going to be able to apply it to your field for sure. That's like even what's happening in architecture that, I mean, years ago, I thought that was going to be a lot more than it's actually happening is that many people are learning how to do visual programming and coding, but it's not that generalized. Like a lot of people don't want to learn Grasshopper. They don't want to do it that way. So, I mean, I guess that means that if you learn it, you have a more niche feel. Otherwise, everyone would be doing the same thing.
Yeah, I think, I mean, part of that is tied to a certain like architectural style that's evolved around separating out computational practices from like the type of work that typically is thought of as like, you know, computational in nature. Like, I think those are two different things. I think all these techniques or tools, and the interesting thing there is how do you have some transferability of the things you've learned? Like, oh, this problem is kind of like this other problem that I looked at before, or generalization and abstraction of a concept that you might be there. And that you kind of have to do it. Like, the more you do it, the better you get at it.
Yeah. And I think no matter how good you are, I think the medium that you work in informs a lot the way your outcomes turn out. I mean, you need to be really, really, really comfortable in a certain environment, let's say Grasshopper or Dynamo or anything, to actually do what you wanted to do without it being affected by where you're working on, right? Like doing something in AutoCAD versus Revit versus by hand, it's going to change the outcome for sure.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, the tools that you're using affect the outcome, no doubt. It's just a nature of any design field. But the sort of concept transference, I think, is a valuable thing. Like, you know, and Python is kind of a good example of that. Like, and we've seen this like professionally before too. Like, oh, I've built this thing before in Rhino, like using Rhino Common and like using Python in Rhino. So there's like concepts that you've learned around geometry or how to deal with objects and how to iterate through things and loop and, you know, do some conditional logic in code in something like Python that are transferable to a different environment that has a similar, you know, set of constructs in it. So that's usually how, like, there's like learning in a certain context and then being pressed with another challenge somewhere else. And then thinking about it more abstractly and creatively and saying, okay, what can I apply from my tools that I have over here, even though it's a different environment? And that's where learning kind of happens and these creative leaps happen. And that's what we've actually seen people do in the industry. Because these tools are so available online, chances are if you've got a problem, somebody else has already had that same problem. So why reinvent the wheel? Like, why not find something you can reuse and repurpose and then share back out? I mean, that's, talk about a fairly large change. Like, that's pretty interesting. But the problem with that, though, is that you lose some level of like a deeper understanding. Like, if you're using, it doesn't matter if it's like a full library or just somebody's script that you downloaded, if you don't understand how it works, is that as valuable? You know, like if you're just executing a function, oh, this, you know, script that I downloaded or, you know, definition or graph or whatever, it rationalized this facade. Okay, but why? Like, how does it work? I don't know. It just makes the right picture. Like, well, but there's like a whole bunch of math underneath that, like UV parameters and figuring out how to make things all the same size and figure out like what the rules, that literally the rules that you care about are embedded in that graph. And if you can't describe them and change them and modify them, then you're just hitting the run button and that's not as useful.
The good thing, and this is what people at ETH University were doing.
Yeah, like the Compass guys, yeah.
They open sourced the library Compass, which is written in Python and is pieces of code that allow you to calculate stresses on different structures and frames and a lot of other really cool stuff. But the cool thing that they did is that they have all the code open sourced and they have different abstraction levels. So you might install a plugin on a program like Rhino and just use it. So you're using the plugin and you don't really know what's going on. I mean, you know the high level stuff. You can use it on visual programming and you can maybe go into some of the components and see the code, or you can actually write code with it. I think that abstraction level is needed because I personally think that not everyone needs to know how your iPhone is doing every operation, right? You cannot go into the code, right? Like there are some other open source systems mm-hmm. that you can do that. But I think that's great that you need an entry point where, okay, first I use it, then I start understanding the logic, and then maybe later I can go deeper and understand all the math that's going on inside.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, no, not everyone needs to be, you know, an expert computational geometer, like, and figure out, like, write their own like NURBS library from scratch. I mean, we know some people that do those things on the weekends and more power to them, but, it's the same thing, kind of thing with a car, like where you need to know roughly how to drive a car and figure out, okay, it needs gas, needs oil, needs this kind of stuff, but you don't need to understand like all of the intricate details of like what happens underneath the hood. But the cool thing about the tools that we're talking about is that they are discoverable and understandable, and there's progressive disclosure. Like if you care, you can enter wherever you want to. Like you can simply be a user, or you can get a little deeper and understand more, maybe tweak it a little bit, or you can get deeper and deeper and deeper, kind of what you said, because inherently they're open tools. They're, you know, you can download the source and take it apart. There usually is some level of documentation and a community around them that can help you. And that is a good learning device along the way. So if you are inclined or interested or have a problem that is just slightly different from what it's doing, you can tweak it, you can hack it. And that's the value. That's where real learning happens. It's literally that. Like, this thing is so close. I'm going to spend those extra night and weekend hours to take it apart and put it back together in a different way. And that's where you get the next level of understanding that makes it easier for you to do it the next time.
Yeah, I think a good example on the website coding world is WordPress, even though I don't love it.
There's like sort of a natural, like, you know, people have a love-hate relationship with WordPress. Yeah.
Yeah, but the good part is that it's open source, has been around for ages. Like, I don't know if 70% of the webs have it or something like that. Has a really good documentation and a lot of community. And any problem you have with it, you're going to Google it and you're going to have, like, I don't know, thousands of people who ran over the same problem as you. So that is why open source benefits a lot compared to proprietary things. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, we've seen that now. I don't really know any, and probably that's why, but proprietary systems to develop websites now, unless it's something like subscription-based, like Squarespace.
Oh, okay.
I mean, you're paying for something that is kind of beautiful and you don't have to tweak that much.
Yeah, those are like, that's kind of like a hosting model. Like that's sort of, there's actually still code underneath that you can get to if you care about it or turn the page over or get to the next level of subscription. But like, you know, same kind of thing with like services or applications that ease the on-ramp onto something. Like, you know, some people like, you know, they just want to get their website up and running and they have their little business that they need to get back to. That ultimately still comes down to using components and technology that are probably open source underneath the covers. They're just not presented in a way that is hackable. But yeah, those are all really good examples. And that's kind of interesting too, because like we live in a community of people that like to hack and tinker and make things. Not everybody's like that. Sometimes good enough is good enough.
So I would like to hear more about, so you're transitioning from Autodesk to Tesla. You've been working remotely. So you've been living in Philadelphia and working with a team in Boston, partially remotely, partially visiting the office to be with the team and to attend meetings and stuff. How's this change going to affect your day to day?
That's actually a really good point. So I think, we didn't even talk about patterns yet, like our work daily patterns of life and things like that. For me right now, I mean, I've always, recently, instead of making things myself, I've been running teams that make things. And the cool thing in technology is you don't have to be physically present all the time to do that. So we have a lot of great technologies we use all the time, you know, video conferencing, instant messaging, all this stuff that's great. And we've been working together, a lot of us, for a really long time. So there's a high level of like trust and like, you know, we know each other pretty well. I've been able to run a team that's been in Boston and in California and in other places, almost the same as if we were all in the same office. Of course, there are things that you need to be physically present for too. And that's important when you're growing a team, when you're doing new stuff, when you're kicking off new projects. So that's required me to travel a lot, not just to go to see customers or go to conferences and whatever, but to leave my house like 5 o'clock in the morning and come to Boston for the day and do meetings and then go home that night, which is not that bad. It's an hour flight, or the next day or whatever. So that's great. But as I do more and more, as we get bigger team, more and more stuff, it just takes more time. So
how many flights do you think you get a year?
I think I had 94 segments, like individual like flights in the year, or like, you know, trips. 47 distinct travel days, but some of those are probably multiple days. So it probably works out to be about 70, 80 travel days out of, you know, how many work days are there a year? Like around 250, to something like that. You know, it's more than a quarter, more than 20%, probably closer to 30, 35%, which is not terrible. I mean, there are people that travel a lot more than I do. But for me, where I'm at in my life right now, it's sustainable. I've done it a lot, but especially for where my kids are at and where I want to be, I just want to be home more, you know, and still work on interesting problems. But instead of coming to Boston every week, what it'll mean for me is going to the West Coast less frequently. So every 6 to 8 weeks, go out west for a week at a time. So that is a little less disruptive and less actual days of travel. You know, it's, again, like, it's not that terrible. Like, I've, being able to work from home at all is great. And more companies are doing that. And it, I think that's valuable as a people manager and as someone that leads a group, because you're trusting your employees. Like, you care about them to say, look, I'm doing something professional and I trust you to do that. Like, you're doing a job, and it's not just like punching a clock. It's like you're doing something that has value, and we're all treated with respect. So it doesn't matter where you are. You don't have to be physically here for the work that we're doing. You can be anywhere. So I think that trend isn't going to go away for certain industries. And that ties back to the building of the right organizations and helping people understand, like, look, here's what we're trying to do. Here's what your job is. Here's what this other person's job is. Here's how you work together effectively. And hopefully I'll be able to do that in this new place too.
So can we talk a bit more about yourself?
Sure.
So I would like to know if you have any daily routines, any morning or bedtime rituals.
Yeah, I think that's a good thing to talk about. For me, I like to, anything that involves concentration and focus, so whether it's design or coding or writing or solving a problem, I like to do that early in the morning. So get up early, have coffee, get some breakfast, and then sit down while it's quiet, nobody bothering you, couple hours, focus time. Get into a sense of flow, like get something done and then wrap it up by the time that you need to do other things. And whether that is other obligations like family related or work related, usually for me, it's a lot of meetings that start up. And luckily, people don't really start meetings before 10 o'clock in the morning on a good day. So somewhere between 10 and 5 or 6 or 7 at night, there's a lot of meetings, you know, for certain people. I find that unless I carve out time to be productive and creative, it doesn't happen. So that's a pretty important ritual. That's one part that's like more professional. The other part is especially working remote or even any kind of desk job that we have, getting out and doing something physical is really important because it helps clear your head, helps you think more efficiently, and activates kind of the subconscious problem solving. Like if you're hard thinking about a problem and noodling on it and kind of stuck, one of the best things that I've learned to do is just detach and just kind of go for a run, go to the gym, go outside, do something else. Kind of consciously don't think about it, but then your subconscious is still working on it. So I like to get outside and work out. I do a bunch of stuff kind of outside of this area that involves rowing on rivers. Like, so you connect with nature, you go out, and a lot of this is like fairly kind of hard work, like physical labor, surrounded by other people from different industries, different backgrounds, but you're all friends and you're working out together and, you know, running or working out in the gym or doing something else. But it's a good way to get your mind out of the thing that you're working on. So that's usually the biggest patterns that I have. And then there's, you know, the obvious stuff like trying to have dinner with my family and kids, trying to make dinner, trying to do things that are not involving a microwave and heating up something. I mean, that's definitely challenging when you have family and activities and sports and shuttling kids around after school and everything. But that's actually a really cool thing about working from home too, is like where I live, a lot of my friends commute into New York City and it's like an hour train ride. It's not that bad, but an hour train ride each way and then waiting for the train at Penn Station, driving home, sitting in traffic. I mean, you're talking an hour and a half each way. So you leave your house at 6 o'clock in the morning, you know, get to New York, 7:30, get to the office by 8, stay till 5, don't get home until, if you're lucky, 7. It was dark when you left, it's dark when you came back, and you haven't seen your kids or your wife.
Well, I personally don't miss it.
Yeah, so that is not, yeah. Speaking from someone that used to have a commute yourself in Boston, even that, I mean, it's a fairly reasonable commute. I mean, you were basically on the red line to the silver line.
To me, it was, I mean, I even enjoyed it some parts, except when South Station was crowded and I had to kind of squeeze.
Yeah.
But I mean, the walk from home to Central Square and the T from Central Square to South Station, it wasn't that bad. I mean, you had like good sight.
I actually really miss commuting on the T for exactly that reason. Like, it was fairly civilized way to travel as opposed to like the maddeningly dull experience of like bumper to bumper traffic on the highway, like driving an hour somewhere each way. Oh my God, I would never want that.
I think it's more about, not so much about the commute being so bad, it's about having autonomy to choose what you want to do in the 1 hour before you start work and the 1 hour when you're transitioning out of work.
Yep. Having some context switching, like having something that you do for yourself to transition is a really important like sort of habit or pattern that I think people should think about. Because context switching, like switching instantaneously, has a cost. Like if you're, you know, on a conference call or deep in thought on something and then you have to switch, it's like being jet lagged almost. Like you kind of have, like it takes time for your consciousness to catch up to like where you should be. So having that transition built in, I think is actually valuable. And in a way, it's kind of the same as like being on a flight. Like there's a reason why it's kind of nice like not having like phone access like on an airplane or internet access sometimes, because it gives you that downtime to read or to disengage. There was a point in time when like cell service got good enough that it worked on in the subways. And I'm not sure if that was a good innovation, because you lose some of that disconnection time and you still have that choice. Like you could listen to podcasts or read a book or whatever, but the number of people that I've seen on, you know, checking email, responding to things, like that connected time when you should be transitioning between home and work is tough.
I mean, you enjoy it when you need it or when you can do something productive, but I don't enjoy that now European flights have Wi-Fi or things like this, because it's exactly what you're saying. Like we have conceptualized planes as this kind of sort of disconnection moment that you have for yourself. You can read a book, you can, I don't know, maybe in your Kindle, or you can do something. Sometimes I sketch, whatever. Mm-hmm. But now you have, you know, you have WhatsApp, you have like email, you have, so it's more time that you can be on Instagram or something.
Right. it comes down to autonomy, like you've mentioned that before too, where you kind of need to control the influences. And it's kind of more than just shutting down your email client or turning off your notifications or something. It's more having that intention, like having a conscious thought of like, I need to do this thing right now. And sticking with that, making it become a pattern, making it become a habit is valuable. That is one of the dangers of working from home, is that you lose that transition time and it's easier to pop back upstairs or go back into your office and check on something.
Yeah, there is this interesting concept that I have to explore a bit more, but is calling devices monotaskers. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, Kindle has a web browser, but I haven't really seen a lot of people use it.
Yeah.
People use it to read as you use a book. I mean, all phones, right? Like you would just send messages, receive messages, and make calls. But now you have a computer on your pocket, and any computer you can install anything, and even on an iPad. So I bought an iPad to write, right? And it doesn't matter. Like you could start getting instant messages, and maybe you can even sketch, which is a good thing, right? Mm-hmm. But I saw this example. I think his name is Devin Lubega. He's an independent designer. They live around the globe on a boat called Pino. And there's like this couple that do hardware hacking and web design and open source applications. And they have this thing where they made a Raspberry Pi into some sort of customized Kindle where they can type and read what they've written. So basically create their own open source iPad. Mm-hmm. Just to write.
Yep.
And you can do that with an iPad, right? You can buy it, you can remove all the apps, but it's this thing that if you can, you'll find a way to do other things.
Yeah, as long as you kind of recognize the value of the sort of monotasker or unitasker. Like I've actually been thinking about that more now, of having a cleaner separation between like in your devices, between like personal and work, I think is actually something that's kind of, you can have two schools of thought, like, you know, nobody wants to carry around like double the devices, but like having some clarity of mind of like, this is work and this is my non-work. And that's kind of useful. Even to the point, like, I mean, social media, like there's a big push to, you know, sort of delete Facebook from your phone or whatever. Like that's kind of liberating. Like not only, I mean, I think Nate Miller posted something recently about this, like he did that. And not only is it clarifying for your thought process, like you don't have as many notifications, you're not going to switch between applications, but your phone runs faster because it's like there's a serious amount of work happening for these things that are constantly competing for your attention. So why give it to them? Why cede that valuable resource that you have of your time in all contexts, like all the time? Like I think that's something that I think people should do more of. And at least between this sort of binary state of working or not working, having it be more clear, the applications or services that you use for work shouldn't be on your home device. And the applications that you use for home probably shouldn't be on your work device. I mean, there's obviously rules from a data standpoint that you should follow, but just from a clarity of mind of like what you should be thinking about at a certain point in time, that's something that's gotten blended in a lot, myself included, for a long time. And I don't think it's actually gaining us that much efficiency. I think that context switching, kind of what you're saying, like on my Kindle, I could check something on the web, but why? When you're present and focused and have some intention, you should have an environment that supports that, be it the physical environment that you're working in or like the hardware that you're using to do it.
Yeah, I think Apple with the new iOS is making a small effort in terms of adding the screen time app where you can see how many times you get your phone or what your average is a week. And you can also do limitations in certain times of the day. And I think it's a good tool that you need to be willing to use and actually put the effort into deciding, okay, I'm going to not use these apps this time for this reason, right? Which is already an effort. I think the problem that I always see is that all the interfaces, we are left to however Facebook or other social media want to design our own experience on their application, right? I can't hate more the fact that Instagram doesn't let you automate uploading a post and you have to do it from your phone. You have to open it and you will see that wheel going around and then you will get what I personally think is an intended delay of 1 second to see your notifications because your brain goes, okay, this is loading. I don't see any notifications. Let me browse these recommended things. And then 1 second afterwards or two, you get 3 likes, 1 random bot followed you. And
yeah.
I never posted that, but I have a question I recorded with Drew Houston from Dropbox, right? Mm-hmm. When I saw him at the Harvard iLab, the innovation lab. And I asked him that, like, how does Dropbox differentiate itself, right? You have a work tool that is supposed to make you more productive and simplify your life. Actually, I realized a while ago that their slogan is simplify your life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He responded like, oh, we don't advertise. We don't make you go anywhere else. We just kind of advertise or give you notifications so you stay on the same environment, right? But whereas WhatsApp and Facebook are all the time like trying to, have this addicting behavior, right? So I don't know. I mean, I personally think something's wrong because nobody's teaching us, right? Nobody's teaching us to make a responsible use of most technologies.
Yeah, I think, that's a good point. And, you look at, like, again, the next generation of kids. I mean, Snapchat is, they don't use Facebook. It's pretty much all Snapchat and Instagram. It changes their interaction with their devices. It changes their interaction with their peers and their friends. And it's altering the way that people interact in pretty dramatic ways that I don't know if we're going to be able to foresee. I mean, these are more dramatic changes than, like, every generation is like, oh, you're going to watch too much TV. You're going to rot your brain, or, oh, computer games are going to, destroy you. You should get off your Nintendo, like, or Xbox, or, Wii, or like PlayStation or whatever. Like every new technical innovation is going to, like, destroy the moral fabric of, like, society. And it never really happens. Like, there's always some mediating influence, but the pervasiveness of phones and screens and applications that are constantly competing for your attention, and these little sort of dopamine hits that you get, like, oh, the likes, like, that are there, that changes more than other mediums that were there before. And I don't really know where we're going from there.
As an exercise, choose one social media, or maybe all of them, and try to go 7 days without going into them mm-hmm. at all. Your brain stops asking you to get that hit, as you said, mm-hmm. like, to go into it. You forget about it. As long as you go once that day, you're going to be reminded, okay, let's go again, let's go again, let's go again. And that's kind of a never-ending cycle of jumping between different apps and different notifications, right? I think we're cycling back to different topics. We were talking about yourself, and I wanted to ask you about if any of those analog things that you do to disconnect and to kind of make your background process mm-hmm. work, are any of those meditative moments?
Yeah, I think so. So we talked about the concept of flow before, like, creative flow, like getting into that is hard, as we know, and staying in it and kind of achieving some effective result is hard. It's also the same thing from a contemplative or meditative state. And we've talked about this before too. So definitely for me, I like kind of two different things. Like, one is the physical activity of working out or going for a long run or bike ride. Like, I do these triathlons and things like that require you to go out and do fairly long, kind of tedious things, right? Like an hour or two of, like, a bike ride or run or something like that. And the same thing for other long workouts where you've turned off your frontal lobe, like you're kind of operating at a lower level in your brain, and your body is working and is active, but your mind is decoupled. It is a meditative sort of state that you can get into. I'm not a runner. Like, I don't think I would ever run a marathon. I've never had a runner's high, but there definitely is a point when after you've warmed up and kind of get in your groove, even without music or without anything else, like, there's a pattern and a repetition, and your body just kind of sinks into this groove that is really useful, both to recharge, but also to get into a state that helps you think differently. And that's hard sometimes. And other people do it with yoga, you do it with whatever other activity, but generally something that's physical. Could even be doing, like, yard work or, chopping wood. Like, that, I've seen that before, people out in a cabin, basically, taking down trees and chopping them up. Like, why are you doing that? Like, because it's like, it gets them in that meditative state. There's just this direct connection with the tool that you're using, like an axe or some kind of wedge and a hammer, that you don't have to think about. Like, you're not calculating, like, the angles and geometry and forces involved. Like, it just happens. And there's a repetition and a pattern to it that helps you get into kind of this flow state that you can think about other things. I think that's pretty valuable. then I can definitely tell, and my family can tell, when I don't get a workout in, generally get cranky. Like, it's just kind of like you need that time away from the thing. And kind of in that same model of getting into a sort of different state to doing something that takes you out of your context. Like, so I do these triathlons, and they typically involve jumping in the ocean, swimming, and then getting out and riding a bike and then running. And the tricky thing with jumping in the ocean is that it's scary. And it's scary because it's dark. You can't see anything. It's not like a pool where you can see the bottom and you can see the lines and it's clear chlorinated water. It's dark. It's scary. There's probably creatures around you. And you're basically in like an isolation chamber, like a sensory sort of deprivation environment where when your face is in the water, you have no other stimuli. Like, you can't hear anything. You can't see anything. And it's pretty interesting and it's scary and people freak out. They have like anxiety attacks when they do that. But if you kind of let go of that and you kind of breathe and get into the patterns that you have, your breathing, your physical motion of your arms and legs, like swimming, and you start to relax and get in the groove. And it's the same as these other experiences where, because you have no other stimuli coming in and you're really only with your own thoughts and you have this repetitive thing happening, your body helps your mind disengage and stops thinking consciously and just goes into the subconscious thought pattern that is really, really great, because you're working hard, you know, you're doing something that's strenuous, but it detaches your brain and you can think about things in a different way.
When do you think you get your best ideas?
I get my best ideas after my first cup of coffee in the morning. Even in college, like, you know, long nights of architecture stuff. If you force it, if you try too hard, you stay up too late, you don't have good ideas at 2 a.m. At least I don't. I get a bunch of information together, get a bunch of thoughts and write them all down, sketch things out, go home. A friend of mine, when we were working on big projects, he'd say like, Matt, this is like a 2 beer and a cheeseburger problem. What do you mean? Like, what is that? Like, well, we've been working hard on this stuff all day. It's 8 o'clock at night. We haven't had dinner yet. Let's go to a restaurant, like leave where we are and grab a bite to eat and think about it and to talk about it a little bit, but have 2 beers and a cheeseburger and then go home and go to sleep. And the next day you wake up and chances are, more often than not, you have the answer that you were struggling to find before because you weren't forcing it.
I know that you like to make stuff. What are other activities that you do outside of work?
A lot of what we do professionally is logic problems. You know, you're sitting around writing code, staring at a screen, thinking abstractly and trying to solve a problem, or even just in larger group settings, like writing on a whiteboard or doing something else. And those are inherently like, even though you're making something new, you don't have that tangible kind of reaction of working with your hands. So that's what I do a lot of when I'm not doing like professional day job stuff, is I have a shop in my backyard now. It used to be in my garage. I have, you know, woodworking and metalworking tools, and I generally make things. And that could be various, you know, pieces of furniture and kind of things for our house. It could be more kind of experimental things or projects like with our kids or something like that. But just the act of making, having a problem, breaking it down into its constituent parts and just executing and making something, and that the spontaneity of seeing what you end up with your hands and working physically with things is really important. So that's definitely an area that I try and spend more time on. At Autodesk, we're fortunate that we have this sabbatical. So every 4 years, we get 6 weeks off. And it's not an academic sabbatical. You don't have to publish. You can do whatever you want. But if you have that amount of flexibility, you should probably use it for something useful and kind of stimulating or reinvigorating for yourself. So that's what I did. I built a workshop and did other things. Like, one of the last ones, we did sculptures in Italy, where we got a chunk of marble and a robot milling machine and came up with a design, programmed the robot, milled this part, and then this sculpture, and then finished it by hand. But that kind of dialogue back and forth between a material and the tool and the craft involved in making it, I think is really valuable.
How do you run away from work distractions or distractions in general, busyness?
Busyness is a fun one. I mean, I think that is a lot of like my professional career is just the nature of the job is you're always busy. There's always competition for attention. There's always a list of things to do. So how do you focus and prioritize? Previous colleague of mine had the analogy of, like, you know, those little lizards that, like, their legs move super, super fast and they can actually, like, run across water because they're light enough and, like, they don't basically break the surface tension of the water. But if they stop moving their legs, they would totally sink into the water. That's kind of how it feels sometimes. Like, busyness is like, oh my God, I got to do all this stuff. I got to keep on going. And if I stop, oh crap, then I actually, like, I'm not going to be effective or something else is going to go wrong. If you can keep all the balls in the air, things are okay. The minute that you look at one for too long or contemplate it, then all the other balls fall.
How do you deal with email?
I do not like email. I'm of a firm philosophy of, if you don't get an answer from me within probably about an hour, you're probably not going to get one. Like, there's kind of two kinds of email. There's, like, the ones that involve, like, a glib, like, one sentence answer. Like, yes, do that. That's a good idea. Or the longer treatise that you need to write out. And I find that the longer treatises are hard to write during the day because it's constantly interrupted. And then I end up with, like, half-written longer treatises that sit in my draft folders for too long. And then I just end up sending them, like, okay, this is, you kind of figure out where my thought is going. I just didn't have time to finish it. So that, I don't think email is the right medium for that type of conversation. Nor is instant messaging, actually. Like, the number of times that I've seen, like, full proposals and ideas come out in instant messaging, like, is absurd. Like, there's like a flow. I mean, we've talked about this before too, like this kind of constant cascade of information that's coming at you. And email and instant messaging are, like, horrible for ensuring that people understand what you're talking about and have internalized it and thought about the consequences of it and are equipped to make a decision. The whole, oh, I sent you an email, or it was on Slack, you didn't see it? Sure, I might have seen it, or somebody else might have seen it that you work with. Implied in that is you saw it, internalized it, and didn't have any violent objection to, like, what I was proposing, and you didn't care enough to actually write anything about it. But so that's not a good way to make a decision. Like, it should be, here's all the information that we have, and then some other way to say, by Friday, I need you to decide, or we are going to decide as a team what we're going to do on this thing. I gave you all the information before, and I'm not expecting you to spend that much time on it. But if I don't hear from you by Friday, this is what we're going to do. And that's what I think. It's not a problem of the technology. It's more of a social convention problem of you have to look at things empathetically, like, from other people's point of view. And there's always, like, constant stimuli coming in. So how do you get what you need from other people organizationally without just inundating them with more email?
How do you deal with clutter?
I think clutter finds me. Like, I try and avoid clutter, but it sort of follows you. Like, there's, like, this digital sort of chafe that kind of follows you around. Like, it's actually kind of clarifying, like, you know, every holiday, you know, you kind of clean your house up, or, you know, clean off your laptop. There's kind of two different people, like, people that organize into settings, that, or other people that, like, literally just put everything that was around in a folder and kind of put it away and say, that's, like, 2018. That's everything that I dealt with in that year is, like, shoved into a closet somewhere and I'll deal with it later. So I think I'm more in that category of, like, there is a rationale to how I organize things, but it might not be apparent to other people.
How would you define personal success, or how would you measure it?
Yeah. So personal success, it's not about money. It's about having a sense of fulfillment. I like the idea of finding smart, interesting people and putting them in a room together and seeing what comes out, like pointing people in one direction and saying that, guys, this is where we should go, is a measure, I think, of success. Like, there's a certain point where it's not just about what you can do yourself. It's about how can you build something bigger than yourself. And I think maybe that, I don't know, I haven't really thought about that before, but, like, that's probably more how I look at the world, is we're all makers, like, we all build things. So how do you build things that will last and provide value? And how do you build an organization that will continue to build the things that you think are valuable?
If you could send one sentence to the world, what would be your message?
Finding the thing that you are passionate about, practicing that till you're good at it, because you're probably not good at it at first, and figuring out how to make that your job. I don't know how else to describe it than that. Like, there are people that work 20 years at a job that they hate. Why would you do that? Like, that's dumb. Like, why not? Try and find the thing that you care about, that you're good at, and that provides some value, and just do that.
What would you tell your 20-year-old self or 30-year-old self?
Take a year off. I think this whole idea of going in the US, like from high school to college to grad school to job. Like, why? Why do that? Why not? And not to take a year off to like find yourself or whatever, but like there's only so many years, man. I was fortunate that I kind of knew I wanted to do architecture and computers, and that's been pretty consistent. There's a lot of people that I know that didn't have that. So why not take a year off and figure out more about what you care about and what you're passionate about? And even if you do know what it is, I mean, you've kind of done that before too, like do something, try it out for a little bit and go a different route. So like, how do you know what route you should go? Then you should probably figure that out before you go to like grad school and like spend more money and time on something. Take a year off, try something. I think I would probably also say figure out how to start a business, because that is something that is scary. And maybe that's kind of forecasting like where I want to go, but like the stakes are smaller. Like if you're to my 20-year-old self or 30-year-old self, like what do you have to lose? Try something out new. And if it doesn't work, you can go somewhere else.
Can you tell us about something that you're paranoid about?
That I'm paranoid about. I think earlier in life, I there's always people that are going to be smarter than you or more creative and things like that. I guess that kind of made me paranoid before, but you kind of hit a point where it's like, especially when you're building an organization, good organizations, like you hire the smartest freaking people you can find and the most creative people you can find. And I've hired people that are really good. And I think that's something that I've noticed is a common paranoia, is if you work with people that are smarter, more creative, or better, then that will look poorly on you as a person. And I think it's actually the opposite. But I don't know if that's a common thing for people to think about.
I wanted to ask you if there have been any books you've read that have influenced the way you approach life.
So yeah, there's a book called Drive by Daniel Pink. It's interesting in that it talks about autonomy, mastery, and purpose. These three areas that I think motivate a lot of people. It definitely kind of resonates with me, where you understand why you're doing something, you're given the space to do it, and you feel like you're in control or have a kind of a sense of mastery of the domain that you're dealing with. So that was one aspect. Another one that wasn't, it's not really a book, but there's a sort of a concept of it that's useful, especially as you start in any kind of new environment, is this idea of influence without authority is probably the best way to say it. People that are in authority are sort of like the kind of military structure, like the, you know, whatever, the generals are kind of top-down organizational stuff or the boss, right? But there's actually the social graph that happens, like where the people that are most influential in any organization that you go to ask a question or to get advice or just have lunch with and talk, they have a lot more influence and they're more impactful, if you think about it that way. I mean, sometimes they match up, but that's one piece of advice I would give that somebody gave to me when I was just starting out doing stuff, is that cultivating some honest, genuine, you know, reaction to things and being sincere will help you gain influence. And it's not about political connectedness or kind of all that sort of organizational stuff. It's not who you know or what you've helped each other with. It's more if you're your true self, you can gain influence. And that's more valuable than being the boss. I guess that's probably the best way. And that's, you know, obviously more confirmed with like social media and like sort of the way good ideas kind of propagate and people that have good ideas are given a platform to be more exposed.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that. I wanted to ask you, where can people find you online?
Obviously social media, LinkedIn, Facebook, Twitter, on Twitter, just, you know, Matt Jezyk, MattJezyk. Same thing with Facebook and LinkedIn. I don't really do YouTube or like have my, nobody does blogs anymore besides like, you know, Getting Simple. I don't have my own podcast, but those are usually the best ways to find me. And then, you know, my normal personal email was just a Gmail account. But yeah, definitely encourage a lot of the people that listen to this. You know, we're all friends. We've all worked together a lot over the years in different places, and I'll be moving to a different job, but you know, definitely stay in touch. So just send me an email, matt.jezyk@gmail.com.
Before we wrap up, I wanted to ask you in general, what's your take on slowing down in life?
Yeah, that's a good one. I mean, it gets back to those patterns, like those 10-year cycles that I was talking about. I think you got to figure out what you want to focus on over that period of time and get rid of the things that are not helping you focus on that and have a goal. part of what I'm trying to do now is, and I don't know how successful I'll be, is to not be that little lizard like running across the water and trying to stay, you know, you're super busy, like 15 meetings, like all this emails and stuff to do all the time. I'm kind of looking forward to having a little more time to make stuff and build things again, because that's what I really liked doing before too. And I really liked the stuff I was doing here, but I think getting into a conscious, intentional pattern of slowing down is valuable. And I mean, we've talked about that before, like, you know, life happens on these cycles. So some people, when you start a company, right, you're figuring out what you want to do or executing on it, but you have a little bit more time to think and do things, and then it grows and grows and grows, and then you don't have any time anymore. Retirement is not really like a concept anymore for people. It's just the next thing. So what is the next thing? So for me, it's about using computers to make real things. This is kind of where I want to be over the next 10 years. Still tied to computational design and generative design and using computers to solve hard problems, but just solving them in the computer, I think, is missing an opportunity. And this is not new. I mean, you know, look at like, you know, Kieran Timberlake's book 15 years ago now, talking about mass customization. But how do we do it in this industry and do it in a way that is not dehumanizing?
I also feel that what you just said, like retiring is not just not doing anything. It's just doing what you want, right? Or presents a new challenge, because when you have a job, you don't really have to think anymore. You just go work and then come back. I recently had this conversation with my mom. Like, she's pursuing her art on the side of being a dentist. And retiring for her would be, you know, like, okay, now I have the challenge of defining what do I really want to do with my time, like every day, full time, right? It's like a new endeavor in some way. So it's not easy. And I think that's the pattern that we're seeing more and more. Like people, I mean, at least that's the case for myself. We long in some way for time to do something else many times. I think also that's a bit of a bad culture. We're never present in the moment. We're always thinking on the next thing that we want to do.
Yeah, I mean, I think I would definitely encourage like staying in the present part. Like there's a lot of value in whatever you're doing. By the same token, like my dad is, he's a doctor and he's thinking about retiring and he's been, you know, scaling back his hours. But he's like, well, what would I do if I completely retired? Like, well, you have all these other things that you wanted to do before. But the whole tying, there was actually like in first year in college, like was good advice that we got from like a professor, like who you are is not what you do. So who do you want to be? I don't know how else to say it than that, but it shouldn't be a vocation and avocation. It should be the things you care about and just different expressions of the same thing. And that's going to change over time based on like where you are in life and the cycles that you're in. I don't think I'll ever play golf or go to like a club. Like that's not interesting to me. I'll probably be tinkering and puttering around and making things for pretty much my whole life. Yeah.
Well, is there anything else you want to talk about or mention?
No, I actually really appreciate the whole podcast and what you've been doing. And like, I think listening to these and, you know, a lot of the people I know and have worked with a lot, but it's always a great way to look at a different side of someone and asking questions specifically around the intentionality around staying simple and grounded, I think is useful. And I've learned a lot from that. And I think it's actually helped me figure out where I want to spend the next 10 years.
Cool. Thank you for your time in between those steps in the water.
Yeah, the irony is the last time we tried to do this, we ran out of time for two reasons. Number one, I had meetings. But number two, we were not quite set up in time. Like we were futzing around with hardware. But I'm happy that we were able to take the time tonight and talk about it some more. And I'm happy to do it again once I figure out what I'm going to do with the next part of my life.
Well, thanks so much for being here today. It's been my pleasure to be able to have this conversation with you. And yeah, I hope we have another one soon. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Nuno.
And I just have one more bonus question before we go. This is what I had to ask you. So you're going to Tesla. So just, I wanted to hear your opinion on self-driving cars.
Yeah. I think I told you the story before. Like I drive Hondas. Like I drive, I'm kind of a Luddite and fairly frugal. So we drive cars until they die. And I had a Honda Accord that I love the engine. I love the sort of normalness of it. And it died 2 years ago. I didn't really want to get another regular car. So I put some money down in a reservation for a Tesla Model 3, which is not the super fancy ones or not the super expensive ones. They're supposed to be like the electric car for the people. And I ended up getting this car like last fall, and it has what's called level 2 autonomous driving, which is not full self-driving. Like level 5 is like, there's no steering wheel. Like that's like crazy talk, but there are people that are going there. So this one is a normal car, nice specs, you know, very safe and everything. But it has this feature that you can turn on that basically does what's called adaptive cruise control and steering. And it has, like we talked about this before too, it has a whole separate computer that is fed by all these sensors, right? So it's really safe. Like there's like 7 video cameras all these ultrasonic sensors and various other range finders and things. And it feeds into this basically a big neural net that is trying to figure out what's happening. And we all know how these things work. We've all built software, and there's going to be things that are not right. They're not trustable. They're actually not deterministic, which is actually even scarier, right? Like these things feed into this black box. And it doesn't matter how big your training set is, like there's going to be weird things that come out the other end. So do you really want that thing operating at 80 miles an hour on a highway? Well, I have my doubts. But that said, I did turn it on, and it was in stop and start traffic over Thanksgiving holiday, like in the US, on a highway. And I had a full car of people, and it was scary as hell. Like it was, the steering wheel is moving and you're not doing anything. You're not touching the pedals. You're not touching the steering wheel, and you're going on a highway. So that was actually very tense the first time I did it. But now on any kind of major trip on a highway, it's actually cuts down on the level of stress and the cognitive load that you have. Like you might think, I mean, a lot of us have driven for a long time in our lives and it's kind of second nature, but you're spending a lot of time processing on these fairly mundane tasks, like just simply steering correction and like watching out for everything else. And you still need to do that. But the level of stress that gets decreased by having this computer doing more for you, literally automating. Like we talked a lot about automation. You can't get much more than that. You know, this thing is taking mundane tasks that we are well equipped to do as humans and doing it actually more efficiently than we can. So faster response time, more prediction, less likely to get tired, and generally will be proven to be safer than anything else. So I'm a proponent now. I just drove up this morning from my house in Yardley, Pennsylvania to Boston. So it's usually like a 4.5 hour kind of white knuckle drive on the highway. This autonomous driving was on for probably 80% of the time on the highway. And, you know, it's not like you're sleeping or anything. It's just like you're still there and you still have to tug the wheel every so often and watch out for things, but it was much less stressful. So I'm a fan. Anything that is like a rote, mundane task that you're not getting value out of should be automated. But the whole idea of like not being able to turn that stuff off and just go fast down a back road somewhere, I don't know if I would want to give that up, because driving is fun. And if you have like a car that is safe and fast and you can use it safely by yourself, like, or, you know, like driving, I don't think people are going to give that up. But for stuff on the highway and definitely for commutes, like we talked about before, that mind-numbing hour of time that people have literally on the highway, why should you subject anybody to do that? There's so much more high value stuff you could do with your brain and your time. I think that that's where autonomous driving comes in.
A pretty complex vehicle to simplify your life.
That's a good point. I mean, it does come back to simplification.
Thank you, Matt. Before you go, I'd like to remind you that you, the listener, are the reason why I make this podcast. If you want to keep up to date with new episode releases and writing, you should join my mailing list at gettingsimple.com/follow. You can find the whole list of episodes at gettingsimple.com/podcast. If you want to support the podcast, you can rate the podcast on the iTunes store, as this is the best way for other people to find about it. And if you want to support it financially, you can become a Patreon at patreon.com/gettingsimple. Now you can listen to the Getting Simple podcast not only on iTunes, but also on Spotify, Overcast, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts, really. As I mentioned earlier, please reach out to me directly on Twitter at getting_simple or on Facebook, Instagram, and Patreon at Getting Simple, and let me know what you think about this episode. Once again, I'm your host, Nono Martinez Alonso, and this is one more episode of the Getting Simple podcast, a podcast for you to find ways to be more productive and creative while enjoying a slower, balanced life. Have a simple week. Thank you so much, and see you on the next episode.